Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper, Tim Bontemps of the New York Post. How's it going?
I'm doing well, Zach. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm in a little bit of pain. If this podcast just sounds weird, like from, it sounds like I'm far away, or if you hear like weird rattling or weird noises throughout, I'm attempting to podcast with you with my ankle elevated and iced. So it's not a natural position.
Wise move.
Yeah, it's not a natural position for me, especially not podcasting. So there's also a chance I may like fall over in my chair at some point. So if there's a crash, I'll make sure not to edit it out.
I was going to say, your move is to always be as relaxed and laid back as possible. So I would say that just sounds like you're in your normal state.
Yeah, no, I definitely like to be that way, but not in this chair, not in an office chair. It's a little hard to do in this chair. So I probably should have found a better way to sit, but this is what I got. I rolled my ankle in the...
That would require hustle.
Right.
That would require hustle, though.
Yeah, I don't hustle. I played with a new group of guys this morning and was playing pretty well, like shot really well early on, moved the ball. I actually played defense because it was a new group of guys, so I didn't want to be that guy.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I know. I was like ripping crossovers.
Let's pause for a second. I've played, for the audience, I've played pickup with Zach, and... we all know Zach likes to talk about gunners and guys like J.R. Smith and
Nick Young,
ultimate idol Ricky Davis,
Jamal Crawford, love those guys.
Yeah, and Zach tries to emulate them on the court.
Love it.
A lot of threes, a lot of three-point line.
Yeah.
Really no defense. Not really worried about trying to get in front of somebody.
Yeah,
so
I'm not trying to be a hero.
To impress people if you're playing with a new group.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be a hero. I was playing with I played for the first time with Adam Cooperstein, who's a local guy here, does radio and TV here.
Sure.
Tom Haberstroh was there. I played with him before, but I had it was a decent competition for the most part for half the teams, and I'd never played with these guys outside of Tom before, so I kind of wanted to show a little bit of effort, so a little bit of a throwback to playing some defense. And, I was ripping crossovers, stealing passes, like all kinds of stuff. Like, I really – and I – Tom's good, so I ended up guarding him the games I played against his team. And so I was, like, really up on him trying to avoid, like, him lighting me up and then tweeting about it later. So that was like kind of my...
Yeah, Tom is good. I played with him too.
Yeah, Tom can play. Tom can shoot.
I saw he came to your defense too.
He did, because I literally like game point of the last game. I don't really know what happened. I either stepped on someone's foot when I went up for a shot inside, or I came down on someone's foot. I just know like I kind of a blink of an eye like felt pain and crumbled to the floor. But there was this guy on my team who I wasn't a huge fan of. Throughout the day, and it really hurt. And I knew immediately, I was like, all right, I can't play through this. Like, and there were plenty of people around, so like someone could take my spot. It wasn't a problem.
Sure.
I knew I couldn't play through it. And some guy came over and he's like, hey, you want some ice? And so, yeah. And so he went and grabbed me a bag of ice. And this guy walks over. He's like, hey man, no pain, no gain. Like, let's go. I'm like, dude, I just landed on the ground. Like, I'm not really like, I looked at him and Tom's like standing right there and he's like, dude, just shut. Well, Tom said it in a not so nice way, but he's like, dude, shut up. And then like the guy walked away, but it was like, I don't need the no pain no gain thing right now. Unless you want to start talking about Mark Wahlberg movies, like that's really the only
right
way I want to
right,
do that.
Exactly.
And like earlier in the
I was just going to say, as we know, our friend Tom has written extensively about injuries. So clearly,
yeah, exactly. Like
preaches about trying to manage them properly.
Yeah, and like earlier, like our team, I don't know. I think we won like five or six straight games to finish out the morning session. We had a pretty good team, and so after the fourth win in a row, I didn't really do much in that game. I think I took a shot, but we just did a lot of like pass ahead, fast break stuff. We kind of ran the other team off the floor.
Right, that's your kind of game.
Right, yeah, exactly. So it was just a lot of passing ahead. And we had two guys who were really good at driving and finishing, so it was just get them the ball and let them go kind of deal. And the guy like walks up to me. He's like, "Are you okay?" And this is before I injured myself. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm good." He's like, "Are you sure? You're looking a little weak." I was like, this is my teammate. I was like, what? He's like, you didn't score a point that game. I was like, we won. He's like, yeah, but you got to score, man. I was like, get the hell away from me.
That sounds like Ricky Davis reincarnated.
Dude, right? I have no idea. I've never been accused of not doing enough in a game my team won before. Like, it was weird.
Listen, man, you got to score. Doesn't matter that we won. You have to get buckets.
And we won like 11 to
result.
We won that game like 11-4. Like, it wasn't even close. So I don't know what this guy's deal is, but I'm.
That sounds like a legendary run, man.
It was good. Like, it was a great run until I rolled my ankle. And I'd hurt my finger on Saturday, and then I've tried to play last night, just half court 3-on-3 stuff, and I hurt it again. So I was like mainly playing left handed last night, so I wasn't quite sure how it was going to go today. But it felt good while I was playing. Like, I didn't hurt it or re-jam it or anything like that. So I was really feeling good about myself. I was playing well, and then ankle rolled.
That's a bummer.
Bad end.
Bummer way to end a run.
Yeah, and then it's like one of those things where it's like, it's my right ankle, it's my right foot. And then, you know, you got to drive back, and that's just not a pleasant drive with the pushing of the pedal and everything. It wasn't so bad that it like really affected me, but it's enough to like you feel every break.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah. I could have really used like some calisthenics before. I think I didn't properly stretch. Yeah, and you know, Mikhail Prokhorov could have maybe helped me out with that.
You know what? I think he has just the thing for you.
Can I
just get some volleyballs and some plywood and some tennis balls and go to work?
I'm sure your experience of it was so much better, but I tell you, like, the first thing I saw of this was the video you Instagrammed of...
Was it the Rondé Prokhorov video?
Yeah, where they're like popping the ball over their shoulder, and like, so I watched it a couple times.
That was the first one I saw you tweeting about.
Yeah, I watched it a couple of times, and it was like the fourth viewing of it, because I was just mesmerized, where I realized Prokhorov was teaching Rondé and not the other way around. Like, I assumed Rondé was teaching him how to do it, and then once I realized it was Prokhorov teaching Rondé, it blew my mind. Like, at that point, I just could not believe what was going on. And then just going through all of your videos, like, it just seemed, well, one, like, we're at day two of training camp, right? That seems
really... It was amazing.
It seems really early in training camp. I mean, I guess when you're a billionaire, you can do what you want, but it seemed really early in training camp to start doing some tricks with volleyballs and plywood and everything. And two, like, it seemed wildly dangerous for players to be trying this stuff.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Like, when I was watching it, you know, I guess I'll backtrack. So we knew for a few days that Prokhorov was going to come to camp.
And for the audience, you're in Durham, North Carolina, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, I should say that. Yeah, the Nets, Billy King played at Duke. I don't know how many people know this. He was a great player at Duke. He was a defensive player of the year. He was on the team. He was on really, I think it was the first really good Coach K Duke team. Might have been the second one. But when he played with Danny Ferry and I'm trying to think, Wilson. I think Quinn Snyder was on that team. There's another. Joe J. Billis was on that team. So, I mean, a lot of people know now. But they all played together at Duke. So Billy's always brought his teams down to work out at Duke for training camp. You know, most of the years he's been an executive, both in Philly and then here. So yeah, we came down here to cover the team for the week, me and Rod Boone from Newsday. And so we knew that Prokhorov was going to come to practice yesterday. So, you know, I figured we'd get to talk to him, and you know, I kept being told, like, you know, yeah, it's going to be worth going. You're going to see something interesting. And I was thinking, well, what is he really going to do? Like, maybe he's going to play horse with Brooke or Rondé or something, or, you know, like, whatever, some funny little thing. And so he was sitting and watching practice when we got in, and we're watching the scrimmage, and he's sitting there. I'm like, all right, you know, we'll see what's going to happen. And then they bring all the players over to the other practice court, and they kind of sit down like they're 10 years old at camp again, like when you used to like sit behind the 3-point line and whoever was running the camp would talk to you for a while.
Right.
And so then Prokhorov drags out these two giant duffel bags, and him and this guy who came with him from Moscow start pulling out all these volleyballs and sticks and tennis balls and pieces of plywood, and I'm just like, what is happening? Like clearly something is going to happen. And for people that, a lot of people probably don't know this, but he's legitimately into this workout stuff.
Right.
Like, I know yesterday's videos look like a total circus, but like he does this for 2 hours a day, every single day, built a 5-story facility in Moscow to like set it up as like some kind of a school for this stuff, like does it religiously all the time. So like he thinks this stuff is stuff that they can actually use in the summer, which I think they probably could. Like, it's really all just agility training.
It looks like core strengthening,
balance, coordination.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's all stuff that is like actually, you know, pretty good for you. But I was standing there as these various drills were happening and players are, you know, trying this stuff, like doing push-ups on 4 volleyballs. And I'm just thinking, please don't have Brooke Lopez or Jarrett Jack or somebody like fall off one of these balls and twist their ankle or bang their knee or something.
Well, that was the first thing.
A week or so or more, and that just would have been a total catastrophe.
Yeah, like there was one where like Rondé and I guess Marco Brown was trying to like do this balance, like sit on a volleyball while, I don't know, dribbling other volleyball, and they like,
yeah,
kind of like, not violently, like that's dramatic, but kind of like suddenly fell to the ground, and then
like,
and then there was a video
of bounce and fell, yeah.
Yeah, and what's the Yes reporter, Sarah Kustak?
Sarah Kustak.
Yeah, she, like, she did it, and she kind of fell to the ground, like, not violently, but suddenly, and I was just thinking, like, someone could, I don't know, like, tear an oblique or something. Like, it didn't seem like there, I mean, granted, I wasn't there, but you were there. Like, it didn't seem there was this incredible supervision and instruction before on how to do it.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, most of this stuff, it was pretty low. I mean, it's pretty low risk stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, some balancing. Like, yeah, there could have been a freak accident. I was just thinking, please don't have there be a freak accident, because this is amazing. if it turns into this is, you know, how could this have happened?
Right.
That would have been a ruining just what should be a fun and bizarre day. But yeah, no, the potential for some kind of issue was there. But luckily, nothing happened, and instead, it was just about a half an hour of pure insanity, really. And it was definitely not anything I ever expected to see.
What was your favorite drill?
Man, you know what? I haven't thought about it. A lot of people that texted me, I got a lot of notes yesterday.
I'm sure.
From all over the league, from friends in the media. You texted me at one point, just like, what is happening? I don't understand these videos. Like, what is going on? A lot of people really like the dribbling the ball on the wall,
yeah,
and the floor at the same time. I was personally the most impressed by the push-ups on the 4 balls at once.
That was legit.
I thought it was kind of insane,
because
he got them all out, and I was like, all right, this will be kind of weird. And I was like, he's actually going to balance and do this all at once. You know, and it was, you know what, I got to say, too, like, that had the potential to be incredibly awkward, because, you know, here's, you know, the owner standing there doing these drills, and he's good at this stuff because he does it every day.
Yeah.
So, like, all these things he's used to doing, so he's just doing them. And, you know, NBA players are prideful guys and competitive guys, so all of them could have been like, I'm not doing that. I don't want to look embarrassed. And then, like, if that's the case, then you're just kind of sitting there and, like, the Prokhorov then has to start kind of telling people to come. You know, like, it could have been really awkward. But to the sincere credit of the guys on the team, you know, they have a bunch of good guys on the team this year. It's a really easy group to deal with. And they kind of just said, you know what, we'll give it a shot. And so basically everybody tried it and tried something. And, you know, by the end of the half an hour, guys are like juggling balls and talking to Prokhorov about these different exercises. You saw the thing with Rondé. He was like asking him for pointers on things. And it ended up being a pretty fun, interesting half an hour. But it had the potential to go another way if those guys hadn't been willing to at least hear him out and give it a shot.
I do kind of wish that this had happened in like the Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce era. That would have been...
Well, somebody texted me about that last night. It's like, man, if it how about if KG would have had to do this? And I was thinking, like, man, if this was 2 years ago, when the last time the Nets were at Duke, and you have a team with Deron Williams and Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and Jason Kidd as the coach, you've got Andre Blatch. Like, you have a lot of guys that like just could have been. It could have been a real comedy fest. If it had happened then, but I think it ended up happening this year. I think they did it that way specifically because I think if they'd had a team that was full of veterans, I don't think they would have, you know, thought it was something that was a great idea to try to throw at them. But you know, Prokhorov even kind of said that we got a young team, and I thought this would be good for them to do. So it was incredibly bizarre, but it was a fun day, and it obviously gave everyone a lot of laughs.
Yeah,
so it worked out pretty well.
And you're right. Like, I mean, just from the pictures and videos and stuff, like it did seem like the players were like legitimately partaking, and not just like, all right, well, let's go do this. Like Shane Larkin seemed to be into it. Rondé seemed to be into it. Like those guys seemed to actually like, hey, if this is what we're gonna do, this is what we're gonna do.
Yeah, I think guys were hesitant at first, but then when they saw it, you know, like I said, you know, they're all nice guys, like genuinely nice guys to deal with, and they're competitive, so they, like, you know, they see the owner doing stuff, and I think once they started doing it and seeing it wasn't the end of the world if they didn't do it right the first time, that, you know, hey, this is fun, let's give it a shot, and see how it goes. And like I said, by the end of it, you know, kind of everybody was messing around, juggling and trying different stuff and trying the drills. And I mean, and it was just so out of left field because I know Billy and Lionel, like the coaching staff and the front office knew what was going on, but no, the players didn't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they just were kind of, everyone at first was just kind of, wait a minute, this is actually what's going to happen. And, you know, then they started trying stuff and got into it. And it was at the end of a 3-hour practice. So, you know, I think guys were, you know, it wasn't like they did that instead of practice or anything. So they were just kind of like, yeah, we'll do this and then we'll go relax for a bit. So,
I'm sure there are worse ways to, like, do your cool down period than.
Yeah. You know, it's a, and frankly, too, Prokhorov's a guy that a lot of those guys hadn't met. And, you know, he's not around all that much. So I think for a lot of guys, it was a chance to actually say hello to the guy and talk to him, which, you know, I think he's a guy that intrigues a lot of people for a variety of reasons, both or from all over the league. So, it was definitely an interesting day. It was far more interesting a day than I would have expected at the second day of training camp, for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of the team, I'm not sure how many people are all that, you know, big on this Nets team because they're just kind of stuck in this.
Let's be honest. No one is big on the Nets.
Yeah, like you'd have to be a homer to be like, yeah, Nets basketball this season.
Right. The Nets have a very boring team.
Yeah.
They have, I think, maybe the nicest team in the league, and I'm not just saying that. Like, in terms of the personalities on the team, they have a bunch of really easygoing, good guys to deal with. Guys like Jarrett Jack is like a legendary good guy around the league.
Yeah.
And, you know, Joe Johnson is a good guy. Thaddeus Young, like you can kind of go down the roster. They got a lot of nice guys, but they don't have, you know, even when they had Deron Williams, they had a guy that was kind of a, a lightning rod and a personality and somebody that people were drawn to, whether to criticize them or praise them. And they don't really have, irrespective of what people think they're going to do on the court, they don't really have that off the court. So they just kind of are there.
Right. I mean, I don't know if this is fair. Like, I kind of am leaning this way. Like, are they the least watchable team this year? Just in terms of, like, pure... I mean, I guess they've got a great broadcast, so that will definitely help things, at least early
right.
on.
Right, Iron Eagle is amazing.
Yeah, like, so he's one of the best, if not the best.
If not the best, right. You know, him and Breen, for me, are probably the two best.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get to watch him call games, that's great. But, yeah, they're not... You know, they don't have any... You know, Brook Lopez is their best player. Brook Lopez is awesome. I think he's going to be an all-star. Assuming he stays healthy, I'll be pretty surprised if he isn't an all-star. But he's not exactly the most exciting player in the league to watch.
Right,
you know,
he
kind of does his job and gets his 19-10 or whatever and goes home.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that this team ends up being even mildly watchable on, like, a night-to-night basis is if Rondae Hollis-Jefferson can play right away, can be effective right away, and, like, has these highlight moments, right? Because he's a freak athlete. So if he can kind of galvanize things.
He's absolutely the one guy on the team. Like, I think if he gets to play at all, I think he's going to be the most popular player on the team by midseason.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, he's a guy that can make a highlight reel play a game. And they don't really have another guy that can do that.
Yeah, like, I guess maybe if everything gets put together for Thomas Robinson, but I just feel like we're saying this all the time.
Markel Brown can throw down crazy dunks.
Yeah, like he can get you a 360 every couple
Brown
of games.
Dunk contest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm already starting the Markel Brown dunk contest.
Dude, it's got to happen.
We're gonna try to make that happen. He could legitimately challenge LaVine. So hopefully, they have a couple guys like that. But again, like, no one's turning on a game to watch Markel Brown or Thomas Robinson or Hollis Jefferson. I mean, they don't have a starting star player that, you know, they don't have a Carmelo Anthony or even a Darren Williams or some guy that's a lightning rod.
Right.
They just don't have that guy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they are a pretty boring team. And they're probably going to play a pretty boring style. They're based around, you know, Brook Lopez and Thaddeus Young, and Joe Johnson's still going to have a significant role, and people always like to say how he's boring to watch. So, yeah, I mean, they're not very exciting, which is why I think, frankly, they're being undersold a little bit. I mean, I think I saw their over-under is like 28.5.
That seems
crazy to me. I personally
think
that's way too low.
Yeah, like, I don't think they're good, but they have enough. I mean, I guess if Brook Lopez went down, then that's kind of what you're banking on if you take the under there.
Sure.
But if they're relatively healthy all year, they have enough talent and you know, experience on the team to be competitive. And I think competitive teams, you typically are in the 30s at least, right? And I don't know that, I don't know if they can make the playoffs. Yeah. I mean I guess they're as flawed as anybody else who's vying for the 8 seed in the East. So I don't know how likely it is they make the playoffs. I wouldn't pick them, but I think they can at least be in the mix for most of the year. But you're not in the mix at 24 wins, even in the East.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're in the group in the East assuming health, which whenever you're doing this kind of stuff, you kind of have to. I think the seven teams that people think are going to make the playoffs, Atlanta, Cleveland, Chicago, Toronto, Washington, Milwaukee, and Miami.
Right.
I think they're all, barring injury, going to make the playoffs. So then you've got, you know, the Celtics, the Pacers, the Pistons, the Hornets, the Nets, and then maybe the Magic and the Knicks if everything breaks right. Like, right. I think those six or seven teams all got better in some ways, are all kind of in the same mix, and could maybe get the 8 seed if things break right. Now, I'm with you. The Nets probably finish 9th, 10th, 11th somewhere. But I heard somebody say, I think Danny LaRue on a podcast yesterday said, like, Sacramento had everything possible go wrong last year and finished with 29 wins.
In the West.
And And I look at, like, them in Denver, right? Like, Denver couldn't have had maybe a worse season and won 30 games.
Right.
So, to me, this Nets team has a pretty good coach. They've got Brook Lopez, who I think is an all-star player if he's healthy in the East, at least. Very good player. Thaddeus Young is probably an above-average starter. You know, they've got some decent depth. I think that team is a 30 to 35 win team. It could be a little more if everything breaks right. And I think unless they have real injury problems, it's just hard for me to see them winning 26, 27 games. I just think if you're in that range, you have to be really bad.
Yeah, I mean,
like last year, I'm just looking at it. Last year, there were five teams that won that few games: Minnesota, the Lakers, the Knicks, the Sixers, and the Magic.
Right.
Like, you have to be really bad to be in that kind of a
range. Yeah, it's really hard to be that bad, and it's like, I mean, and of the teams you mentioned, you know, maybe they would have been under 28.5 wins anyway. But Minnesota, Los Angeles, the Knicks, those three teams of those five, like, suffered big injuries throughout the entire season, right? So, like,
you, right.
Like, that's an injury situation where maybe they're 30-win team right. without, but that's why they were so bad. The Sixers were so bad because they wanted to be, and then the Magic were just a really young team who couldn't figure things out and had a bad coach all year.
Right, exactly. And I understand why people, for instance, are worried about Brook Lopez.
Yeah.
Being healthy. But, you know, like I said to you before we came on, we got to see some of scrimmage yesterday, and Brook looks really good. I mean, I know it's just a scrimmage, and, you know, he's playing against bigs like Andrea Bargnani. So I'm not trying to say he's going to be Will Chamberlain this year. But this is the first summer, I think, since 2011 during the lockout when he hasn't had some kind of off-season procedure on his foot. And last year he was pretty much healthy, missed a few games with some kind of weird back thing, but was basically fine. And was really good the second half of the season, averaged, I think, almost 19.7, I think, over 9 rebounds a game, shot 52 or 53%, was a terrific player, was better defensively. I think him and Lionel Hollins kind of figured out the right ways that I think Lionel figured out how to deploy Brook properly at both ends of the court. Kind of figured out how to maximize his size on defense and find, you know, kind of the right spots to get him the ball in the mid post on offense where he can shoot his like 7 or 8 foot floaters that, it's a really high percentage shot for him. So I just think he's going to be really good. And with the pieces they have to fill in around him, I just think that's enough for them to be mediocre. And frankly, as a lot of people know, the Nets don't have their pick from the Pearson Garnett trade, and so they're going to be competitive right to the end of the season, and I think they have enough to be good enough that they're not going to give up a top 6 or 7 pick to the Celtics in that trade. And if they can do that, you know, say they give up the 10th pick if they don't make the playoffs, and they go into next summer with close to $40 million cap room to start adding some more pieces around Brook and Thaddeus Young, I think they'll consider that a successful season. I mean, that's not the kind of thing you can put up on a banner and really say, hey, this is, you know, we're striving for mediocrity.
Yeah, you're not throwing that on the media guy.
yeah. Like the goal, you don't want to make the public goal to be striving for mediocrity, but, you know, frankly, this is a team that went for it. It didn't work. And now rather than chasing good after bad, they're trying to transition without totally bottoming out. And, you know, I think they put themselves in a position where as long as injury doesn't derail them, I think they've got a chance to at least be able to accomplish that.
Yeah, the more I look at it, the more I'm with you on this Brook Lopez thing, just because, one, he's really good. I think we kind of forget that. And I think it got lost on, a lot of stretches of the last year.
That comes back to how boring the Nets are, right?
Right. Yeah.
Nobody likes to watch the Nets, and I mean, it's not even a whether it's a. I mean, it doesn't really matter to me. But people are down on them. I mean, they're down on the Nets for the marketing and a lot of other stuff, which is also fine. But they're a team that's easy to kind of mock, and you forget about Brook. He's quiet. He doesn't really like doing media stuff. He's not a big personality out there that people are noticing. And his game is boring. I mean, he comes down and makes 8-footers and, you know, kind of gets in the way on defense. But he's not like you said, like Rondé's a guy who can make a highlight play. You're almost never going to see Brook Lopez make a highlight play.
Right.
He's just going to score a lot and pretty efficiently and block a couple shots a game.
Yeah, I mean, the last two months, March and April, played 25 games, 20-9 every night. He averaged almost 5 free throw attempts a game, and I actually I would expect the free throw attempts to go up this year. I know he isn't just a pounded into the paint kind of thing. Like, he has a face up game, he has a jumper. He's pretty smart in how he kind of spreads out his offense, but I just think he'll draw a lot more fouls. He's a great free throw shooter. He's like 81%. Free throw shooter, he's an efficient scorer, you know, shot 51% from the floor last year. Like, he's just a guy that you can run your offense through and get a bunch of points, and maybe those will end up being empty points because the team will be bad or they won't be as competitive as they need to be. But, you know, over 20 points a game for him does not seem insane by any means. It seems almost maybe a lock as long as he's healthy.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what I'm curious about too? Like, I know I said before that he's a guy that's kind of always kind of shy from the spotlight, and he's been able to because he's, you know, his first couple years in the league, he played in New Jersey and was on a team that just was bad, and he was kind of finding himself as a player. And then basically ever since then, he's had Darren Williams and Joe Johnson and Pierce and Garnett were there for a while, so he's always been able to kind of be a guy who could just float in the background. But now, you know, he's 27 years old. The Nets, he signed a big contract this offseason to stay with the team. They're clearly his team. He's the guy they're building around. Everyone's saying it. They've told him he needs to step up more. And frankly, you know, he's said all the right things about, you know, I'm ready to be the guy for this team. I want to be the face of the team. I want to be the leader. It seems like he's being more vocal. He said he wants to pass more, which anybody who's watched him play knows he doesn't really pass at all.
Right.
But again, it was one scrimmage, so I'm not going crazy about it. But he made a behind-the-back pass to a guy cutting the basket, which I had not seen him make before. And he had a nice kick out to a guy for a three. I think it was Jarrett Jack, out of the post, which he also I'd barely ever seen him do before. So if he is serious about that kind of stuff, and he does take a step forward after having, again, the first summer in 4 years to really work on his game and not be sitting around rehabbing his foot for some reason or another, you know, that could maybe raise the level higher than we expected. So, you know, I do think he's a guy worth paying attention to. And I think if he gets to play around, Hollis Jefferson will be too. And then after that, you've got a lot of guys that are reclamation projects that are hoping to bounce back their careers a bit, which, you know, like you said before, isn't really the most exciting thing to want to watch.
Right. But I guess, well, that was my next question about Brook is, do you think he'll end up being the leader of this team, or is that just kind of like Jarrett Jack because he's the de facto talker, right? Like, he's always, like, he's such a personable person.
Right.
He's always bringing people together. Kind of, and some Warriors fans who are listening to this will laugh because he ended up taking a lot of Steph Curry shots the last year he was in Golden State, but especially late in games. But I do think, like, he's just a natural leader, and I wonder if Brook will try to step into that role more, or if it will just kind of be natural for Jarrett Jack to take that.
Well, I'll put it to you this way, all right? Brooke's never been a great talker, and there's been plenty of times in the past where I haven't had a need to talk to Brooke after a game.
Right.
That's not the case anymore. Like, even if he's not a great talker, he's going to have to talk all the time.
He's the guy.
Because he's the best player on the team. Like, yeah. That's just the way it is. So he's not going to be able to just kind of be in the corner and, you know, say a couple things and leave. And, you know, I think he's tried to take that on. The other thing I should mention about the Nets, since we haven't talked about it and we're kind of previewing the year for them, the Nets are basically banking on the fact that chemistry is going to win out over numbers. You know, everybody knows what happened with Darren Williams this summer, him getting bought out so he could go back to Dallas. And a cloud was lifted off the franchise, to be perfectly honest. He was a guy that was not happy to be here, didn't want to be here, and, you know, found a way to leave and go to where he wanted to go. And the Nets now, like I said before about the Nets having a group where everybody gets along, you know, Jarrett Jack, he's everything you want to be as a point guard off the court in terms of being a guy that's going to bring people together, being a guy that's good in the locker room, guy that has friends with everybody, going to try to pump everybody up, all that stuff. And That's all the stuff that Darren Williams wasn't. It just that was stuff he just, that was never something he was comfortable doing.
Yeah, and so, I mean, and Darren was just kind of like just miserable. Like, it was just a miserable personality. And
yeah, he was.
You know, I think you have to take.
He wasn't happy in New York at all.
Yeah, I think you have to take a lot of his comments or a lot of Paul Pierce's comments with a grain of salt, because I think it is a biased view. But I also think, you know, Pierce seems truthful enough. That wasn't supposed to be a pun, but I guess maybe it was. Pierce seems truthful enough where, like, you know, I kind of buy everything he said about Darren Williams. I don't think that's crazy to assume, like, even 90% of that stuff was probably true. And I just think, like, you do... It sucks being around a person who doesn't want to be there.
Yes, totally. Look, I can tell you from... I mean, the day the buyout happened, I was in Las Vegas. And you could just feel a sense of relief from everybody that it was over. And this isn't to say that Darren Williams is the world's worst human being, because he's not. But he wasn't happy there, and it just wasn't a good situation for everybody involved. And, you know, this was the best outcome. You know, they couldn't trade him, and so this was the best outcome for everybody involved. And, you know, the Nets are hoping that if we all get along better and everybody's pulling in the same direction, that's going to translate to us being better on the court, even though we're not as talented this year. I mean, no one's going to argue. I mean, people like to crap on Darren Williams and say he's a bad player now. He's not a bad player. He's still a good point guard.
He's not a superstar.
A superstar point guard, yeah. Right. He's not a point guard that was worth $20 million anymore. But he's still, you know, I think he's better than what Rajon Rondo has turned into still. I mean, he's a good shooter. He can still pass. He can run an offense. He can do stuff for you and help you. So they're definitely not going to be better talent-wise with Jarrett Jack and Shane Larkin and Donald Sloan playing minutes at point guard that Darren Williams would have played. But they're banking on everybody getting along, everybody pulling in the same direction, everybody buying into what Lionel Hollins wants to do, and that translating into them being able to be just about as good as last year. And – you know, I'm really curious to see how that works, because there have been times where we've seen teams that have good chemistry that kind of allows them to do better than expected and, you know, see a bit of an artificial boost in what people would have thought they would do. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if that works for them, because that clearly is what they're banking on with the moves they made over the summer.
So I know it's really early to forecast this, but I'm a lazy question asker. So I want to know who you think has the best chance of making good on a reclamation project between Shane Larkin, Andrea Bargnani, Thomas Robinson, or Quincy Miller.
Well, I'm going to probably cancel Quincy Miller out because I don't think he's going to make the team.
Fair enough.
The Nets have 13. I think they like him. There was some initial reporting when they made the trade for him, to trade Steve Blake to the Pistons for him over the summer, that he might get cut. But I was told right away that he was going to be kept, and he was. And if they do somehow get rid of a guaranteed contract during camp, I think he could maybe stick. But I think they've got 13 guaranteed contracts, and then they gave Willie Reed a $500,000 guarantee, and I think Donald Sloan got a couple $100,000 guarantee, as who's probably going to be the third point guard, I think. So I think the roster's pretty much set. But leaving him aside, I think Thomas Robinson and Shane Larkin kind of both could be. I mean, I think Bargnani is what he is. I think we've talked about him back in – I think we might have talked about this back in July. But when he signed, you know, I kind of asked around and, you know, it's kind of like what happened here. And I think the Nets have kind of compared it to when they signed Andre Blatch a few years ago. As a guy who was making a lot of money, was in a bad situation all the way around with the Knicks. He was, you know, they traded a first round pick for him, which was a foolish trade, and he's making a lot of money and he couldn't stay healthy and just was a disaster. But if he's going to play 15 minutes a game for you and that you just come in and score a little bit, you know, he can do that. Even last year, he scored a pretty decent amount when he came, played in games and shot a decent percentage. So at least overall for the field, I don't think his 3-point shooting was great. So I think he's got a chance. You know, and Thomas Robinson and Shane Larkin to me are both kind of the same guy. you know all about what was going on with the Kings when Thomas Robinson got drafted there. And he plays there for a bit, then he goes to the Rockets, then he goes to the Blazers where he plays some, and then kind of, you know, gets dumped last year at the deadline. And I think he clearly can develop into kind of a more athletic version of Reggie Evans if that's what he decides he wants to be. He's a good rebounder. He's athletic. He hustles. He works hard. Those guys can be valuable, and he can carve out a career for himself, I think, if he really puts himself to doing that. And that, if you look at the Nets, you know, Brook Lopez rebounded well towards the end of last year, but he's never been a great rebounder. Thaddeus Young's not, I mean, he's a decent rebounder, but he's a smaller power forward anyway. Bargnani's not going to rebound. So there's a clear role for him on the team. If he can step into it, I think he's got a chance to play well. And Shane Larkin kind of fascinates me. Here's a guy people loved in college, really dynamic guy, really fast, really good in the pick and roll. Gets drafted by the Mavericks, seemed like a nice fit there as kind of a complimentary point guard to what they had. And then he breaks his ankle before summer league even starts, or fractures his foot or something. I don't remember exactly what the injury was. But basically misses half his rookie year, never gets in a flow. Then he gets traded to the Knicks, who immediately turned down his option for this year, which is like $1.5 million, which was kind of weird, or I think even less than that, without even seeing him play. And then he's this tiny point guard trying to run the triangle, which is a offense for big point guards that doesn't run pick and roll at all. So it just was a total opposite fit to his skill set. So, you know, the Nets wanted to run the pick and roll. They wanted to get out and transition. They wanted to play like he did when he was at Miami, which I don't know if he's really gotten a chance to as a pro. So now he didn't play great last year for the Knicks, but I don't know how much of that is to blame on him or the system he was in or the fact that the Knicks really didn't have any NBA players by the end of the season. To answer your question, I think Thomas Robinson has the best chance. And I think that Larkin, I'm most interested to see what he can do, because I think he's kind of an enigma as a player at this point that we really haven't gotten a good answer to what he can be.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I was never big on him. I know he got a bunch of steals at Miami, and he had one good year shooting the ball from deep, and the year before he was a disaster shooting the ball. Well, not a disaster, but just not good. And I just look at him. He's a small guy with like short arms.
It's tough to be even an average defender when you're as small as him.
Yeah, so like it makes me wonder, like, did he get a bunch of steals because he's a good defender, or did he get a bunch of steals because he gambled? I guess if he gambles correctly in the NBA, then, you know, it doesn't matter. But I don't know. Like, it's weird. I look at him and think, like, if I'm going to have a small point guard out there who has the potential, I guess, to fill it up a little bit, like, I'd rather have Ryan Boatwright from this roster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would agree with that.
Yeah, I just think Boatwright has like that ability to make shots, and I think that's the key to if you're gonna have a small point guard, like give me the guy who can shoot.
Yeah, that's fair. As the shooter, I would expect you to say that.
Right. Exactly. So maybe I'm a little biased there.
No, but that's fair.
Yeah,
but that's fair. You know, and he's even said he needs to shoot better. I mean, he's said that pretty much straight away. That's something he has to do better at. I mean, it's kind of a weird comparison, but I just thought of it. Like, I think if he's going to work as an NBA player, he has to kind of be like Grievous Vasquez, which I know is a weird comp to make because Grievous is like 6'6" and pretty slow.
Right.
but Grievous is great in the pick and roll. And even though he's not a great defender, he's really good in the pick and roll and finding guys. And so he's been able to be a good backup point guard because of that. I mean, he's not a good defender. He's never really been that good of a shooter. He's made some shots, but he hasn't been great.
Yeah, but not to say it doesn't matter, but like if my backup point guard can run an offense and isn't a good defender, I don't really care. Like, I think you want one or the other, but if the defense isn't there, as long as the dude is getting the second unit into the offense and they're scoring efficiently, like, I think you live with that pretty often.
Well, there's a reason he's a backup, right?
Yeah, exactly.
At the end of the day. Like, right. He's going to have flaws. So, I see Grievous shot 39 and 38 the last 2 years, but the 4 years before that, he shot under 32%, 32 right. or under 3 out of the 4 years.
Right.
So, if Shane Larkin can get back to the guy who was in college, who was good in the pick and roll, can, you know, get around screens and get in the lane and make some plays, then I think he could be a good change of pace backup point guard, which at this point, you know, that would be better than what he's been so far.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious to see what he can do, because I don't think he's gotten a real chance to play in a system that works for him yet. So I'm just curious to see how he looks. But I do think Thomas Robinson has a clear skill as a guy who's going to go rebound the ball and bust his tail and work hard.
Yeah.
And I think that, assuming he embraces that, I think he is a guy who clearly could have a long career as a lunch pail go-to-work guy. I mean, hell, Reggie Evans has played for, what, 12, 13 years in the league?
I mean,
with no real skill set?
Whatever. Like,
Robinson's bigger and faster than him.
Yeah, it was Philly, but, I mean, he had a 30% defensive rebounding rate in those 22 games with Philly, and a 15% offensive rebounding rate, 22% overall. Like, those are some incredible rebounding numbers. And it's small sample and all that, but if he can do even...
stops, he would at least rebound the ball there, too. Like he would work hard. He's not like a guy who's floating through games. I mean, he's always running around with his head on fire, with his hair on fire playing. So, you know, I think you can live with that. So, but that's the thing. Like, right, the Nets, I think, deserve some credit, because they were in a situation where they didn't have very much flexibility, and they obviously were kind of stuck with the roster they had, and they get Brook Lopez and Thaddeus Young back, I think, on really good contracts. Didn't give either one of them the max, which I was kind of surprised by. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Brook might have got the max, but Thaddeus got, I think, 4 for $52 for a starter. A starting quality player in the current market is a very reasonable contract.
Yes.
And then they went out in free agency and they got guys like Larkin and Robinson and Wayne Ellington. And, you know, they even signed Bargnani for the minimum. I mean, I wouldn't have maybe given a player option to some of those guys like they did, but at least they went out and took chances on guys that have upside and have potential. And, like, if they work out, could outperform their contract. And I think they kind of maximized their leverage for what they had, and at least gave themselves the best chance to be as successful as possible for this year, which, you know, I think a lot of people going into the summer wouldn't have thought they'd be able to do. So I at least give them credit for that.
I know it's early, but what are any impressions on Chris McCullough? I admit, like, I didn't watch a lot of
hasn't done a single thing yet. He hasn't done a single thing yet.
Like, oh, at all?
He's not. Well, I mean, I don't think he's even going to be back. Lionel Hollins said Monday that he is going to be on the court sometime in January.
Oh.
And Billy King said last week that they're going to announce a timeline for his, like, how his actual recovery to the court is going to go after their first exhibition game, which is Monday against Fenerbahce.
Got it.
So. But I think the view on him is he is going to be, like, I think he'll get some games latter half of the season, March and April, maybe in February if everything breaks right, or maybe if they have some injuries, maybe a little sooner, just to get his feet wet a little bit. And then I think all along they've kind of viewed him as a guy that, you know, here's a young guy. Would have probably been a higher pick next year if he'd stayed in school and come back from his injury fine. And, you know, we're going to take him at 29 and, you know, we can package him as our lottery pick next year and our first round pick at least next year, and then have him ready to go day one for next fall. And then he can step into the rotation for them next fall as a backup big behind Thaddeus and Brooke.
I completely forgot about the injury.
But I do think there's a chance he could. What's that?
I completely forgot about the injury.
Yeah. I mean, he's recovered pretty well. I mean, he doesn't seem to wear a brace. He's walking around. He's down here working out. But I don't think he's going to be back on the court in any kind of a scrimmage situation for a couple months. But I do think he's a guy that could at least get some minutes, you know, towards the end of the season, just so he's not totally raw going into the summer and into next season.
He was someone where I didn't have a great feel on his game, and I don't know if you can after, I don't know, he played like 15 games for Syracuse, and I don't watch a lot of Syracuse basketball anyway. The people who, well, this will sound dumb, but like the people who were sold on him, or at least on, as like a, yeah, maybe the end of the first round guy, like they were really sold on him.
Well, I think to quote a friend of ours and enemy of the podcast, Ethan Sherwood Strauss, who always is championing the block and steal rates for players. I think another friend of ours, Devin Karpersian, put up a stat the other day that he's the only player that was drafted, or might have been the only player in the NCAA who averaged over two steals and blocks per 40 minutes. And like you said, it's a 15-16 game sample size, so there's only so much that you can buy into that. But he at least did show the athletic ability to do that.
Yeah,
and that gives you some optimism that he could be a guy that could be a factor on defense. He's really long and he can shoot. So, you know, if you want to dream on him as a stretch four that can play some defense and shoot the ball, I mean, that's what everybody wants. So if you can get a guy who can give you that, even in a backup role with the 29th pick in the draft, you're probably going to be pretty happy.
Last thing before we go, today is the deadline for Tristan Thompson to do something, to either sign the qualifying offer, or I guess the Cavs can extend the qualifying offer if they want, or the deadline, or they could all come to an agreement of a deal. Apparently, Tristan is willing to take a 3-year, $53 million deal at some point. I don't know. Like, maybe this is a discussion for another day, and I've talked about it a little bit on here, but I just want to get your impression because you've got good perspective on this stuff. Like, I just feel like Rich Paul butchers restricted free agency. I mean, this is the second straight year where we've got a debacle with a restricted free agent of his, having Bledsoe last year and Tristan this year, and I don't know. Like, I just don't know. It just seems to me like the way to handle it is to go out and set the market. And he just doesn't do that.
Well,
and to me, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, this is complicated for me because restricted free agency has kind of become a mess.
I mean, it's a terrible system. It really is a terrible system.
Yeah, I mean, the system is basically set up for no one to offer a contract to anyone.
Right.
So it's hard unless you're in a situation where you have a team like the Blazers that, you know, decided to offer Enes Kanter that huge contract. And who knows, maybe that was in part to just drive up the price for another team in their conference, to get them to match it. But unless you can find a team that's willing to offer you that kind of a contract, it's just kind of hard to set the market. And
but that's the thing to me. Like he couldn't go out last summer and get the Sixers to throw out an offer sheet that you knew the Suns were gonna match. Like you couldn't. I mean,
well, I don't know if the Sixers. But here's the thing: I don't know if the Sixers were willing to do that.
Maybe not. But I'm
I've heard, it sounded like the Sixers this summer were willing to offer an offer sheet to two guys.
Yeah,
Kawhi Leonard and Jimmy Butler.
Right.
So if they're not willing to offer an offer sheet to anybody else, it's kind of hard to do that. And you can look at the Blazers. I know they did offer an offer sheet to Enes Kanter, but I would imagine they don't have any interest in Tristan Thompson, or they would have done the same thing to him.
Maybe. I mean, unless Rich Paul's just sitting there waiting for the Cavs to come to the table, which I just think is a bad strategy. You look at Gordon Hayward went out and got a deal last year in restricted free agency, and it was a great deal. Like Charlotte went out. Like I just think you go out there and convince someone, hey, this team may not match, and here's a really good player.
Yeah, Yeah, I think the problem there, I think, is that Gordon Hayward plays at a position that is surprisingly weak in the league right now.
Sure.
There's, as you know, there's not a lot of good wings. And I think people looked at him as a guy that they thought they could get. Let's offer him a giant contract, and we'll see if Utah is willing to spend the money to match it. Now, of course, Utah obviously did immediately and didn't work out. But there's not a lot of teams that need a guy like Tristan Thompson right now. So, and frankly, if you look at last year, I mean, we can say that Rich Paul butchered it, but he still got $70 million for Eric Bledsoe.
Yeah, but wasn't he supposed to get a max? So, that's my point, is like you have two guys who are these alleged locks maybe. For max deals, and then they don't get the max. I mean, we don't know what Tristan's going to get yet, but they don't get the max. So to me, like, yeah, you still got a lot of money, but you didn't get your market value or what was assumed to be your market value, and that
right.
can be tricky.
I think it's kind of hard. To me, I think it's hard to criticize Rich Paul for not getting Tristan the max, because I don't think Tristan Thompson, in the eyes of anyone, is a real max player.
Well, I agree.
He's a good player, but you know what? And here's the other problem with all this too, right? No one has any idea what the hell is going to happen the next 2 years. Next summer, people are saying the cap is going to go to $90 million. I mean, look, this year the cap was supposed to be 67, I think, and ended up at 70, or 69 and ended up at 70. Next summer, if it's supposed to be at 90, it could be at 93 or 94, who knows, with the way the money's coming in.
Yeah.
And the next summer, there either could be a lockout or the cap could go up another $15 or $20 million.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was loosely projected to like 108, and hell,
yeah,
that could be 115 or something like
108.
Yeah.
Right. It could be all over the place. So everyone in the league is trying to figure out how to navigate that, and I think that in this situation, you've got Rich Paul and Tristan Thompson who are saying our guy's worth the max. And we think he should get it. And they have the leverage of Cleveland not being able to replace Tristan Thompson, even though Tristan's not a superstar. He's a good player. And that's a team that's obviously trying to win right now. And he's friends with LeBron, and they have the same agent. So they feel like they have some leverage. And the Cavs are on the other side going, we've spent an ungodly amount of money already. Now we have to try to re-sign you. And we think we're already paying you more than you're worth, giving you 5 for 8. So I've kind of always thought from the beginning, this is going to end with Tristan getting 5 for 85. And he gets a little more than Draymond, and he doesn't quite get the max, and everyone's happy. And that's where it ends. You know, I don't know if they're going to allow him to extend the deadline tonight. I think the Cavs have the option to allow him more time.
Right.
To sign, which I wouldn't be surprised if they did, just so it doesn't get ugly. But yeah, it's just kind of a weird game of chicken. And, you know, I think it's just hard to say, because this whole restricted, I think, you know, you look at Kevin Serafin took the qualifying offer last year, and then this year he signed for the room exception. I think he's a Rich Paul guy. So you
right.
could say, that didn't really work out. Maybe he should have taken some offer from the Wizards. But I think if Tristan takes the qualifying offer, I think you're not going to know the answer to whether Rich Paul was right or not until next summer.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that
if he goes into free agency and he signs a max deal with Toronto, say, to go play back in Canada
man,
and
what a
play,
bad
play
idea
there, then what's that?
What a bad idea that would be. For Toronto.
Yeah, I don't think it would be great, but I mean, if he gets a max deal from the Raptors or some other team,
yeah,
then you'd have to look at it and say, well, I guess he played his hand. You know, he got his guy even more money than he would have got signing this summer.
I think that's the thing for me.
I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah, I think that's the thing
really
for me
don't.
Too. Is you look at, I mean, when it looked like for the 5 minutes we thought that he was getting a 3-year, $53 million deal, the support of why it was such a good deal for Tristan was like, oh, well, now he can capitalize on the bigger cap in 3 years and maybe 2 years if there's a player option or whatever. I'm like, are we sure he can capitalize on that? Because he's a very niche right. player who we're not sure how he has any, you know, how he has this value. To me, like, to assume that, oh, in 2 years he's going to capitalize this on, like, it's not LeBron taking a short deal. You know, I mean,
right. I don't understand why Tristan Thompson wouldn't just take 5 for 8.
Right.
Personally. But, and again, like, so again, trying to be somewhat fair to Rich Paul, maybe Tristan saying, I want the max or I'm not signing. And if Tristan Thompson is saying that, then as his agent, your hands are probably tied.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, maybe he's saying, I think you should take this deal. This is a great contract. You could play with LeBron. You're going to be on a really good team. And he's saying, nope, I think I'm a max guy. Then at that point, you have to go, well, I guess, all right, we'll just see if we can get you the max then. I don't know. Just it's just free agency, this, especially restricted free agency, is just so – the system is so weird in how it's incentivized for the teams that it just – it makes the negotiating in it difficult. I mean, even when how late in the game was it when Pekovic signed? Wasn't that like September 1st when his contract got done? And they were just kind of sitting around for months, and it was like, well, he's going to sign with the Wolves eventually.
Yeah, I think it was like maybe mid-August, maybe late August. But yeah, it was definitely late in the offseason.
That was something where it was like 6 weeks later, everyone kind of knew what the outcome was going to be.
Right.
But it was just a matter of when it was going to happen. So... yeah, I think it's easy, and I'm not accusing you of this. I think it's easy to just look at stuff like this and say, the team should just, you know, and I think it's easy to argue the other way and say, well, the Cavs should just sign Tristan for the max, even just to get it done and have him there and have him happy. They have plenty. Dan Gilbert has plenty of money. And they're making tons of money. They might win the title.
They're printing money in Cleveland. Yeah, they're basically printing right. money at this point. I mean, right. but I also right. understand, like, man, to commit another, I don't know, maybe $50 million than you need to. Like,
oh right, sure.
Like, the reason he's rich is because he doesn't have to do stuff like that.
Exactly. Exactly. So I was just going to say it's easy to say that on the Cavs side, and it's easy to say on the Tristan side, why are you not taking $80 million? That seems like it's a bet over what you would make in the open market anyway. Take it and go home. So it's just complicated because there isn't real leverage, and it's hard to get some team. Because, and the other thing is, too, if you're one of these teams, you might just say, well, look, there's no way Cleveland's not going to match no matter what we offer them. So what's the point? Why are we bothering?
Yeah,
you know, Enes Kanter, with the Thunder, there was a chance that they might say, we're not going to match this, and then you get Enes Kanter on your team. And I'm not saying that's smart of these teams to do it that way. I just think a lot of them look at these situations with these guys that aren't going to go anywhere. And they say they don't bother because the system doesn't incentivize them to try.
Oh, definitely. No, I agree with that. That's why I just think, like, sitting back and waiting for a team to give you a max offer is crazy. Like, I just think that's, you know, granted, I'm not an agent and I'm not negotiating contracts. Yeah. But I just think that – I think that's a bad – like, it just seems like every player who gets paid in restricted free agency, aside from the superstars who we know are going to get money, it's because they went out and got an offer sheet. And I just think, yeah. like, I mean, just I think guess, that's the I way you have way, to attack this horrible system if you're the agent.
I guess the way I would look at it is, I mean, is there a situation where Tristan is going to get more than, was he going to get more than $16 million from a team this summer?
I mean, maybe not, but Enes Kanter just got, you know, 70. Like, that's, to me, it's, you know, there were
right, well, he got a max offer, right? Or just south of one,
or just he's in the neighborhood of a max offer, if not a max offer,
right?
Maybe Tristan wasn't
getting a better offer than 5 for 80 from another team.
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
maybe that was the best offer that was out there.
Yeah,
I mean, look, I would think if Tristan Thompson could have gotten, I could be wrong about this. But I would think if somebody was willing to offer Tristan the max, I think he would have signed an offer sheet.
I agree because then you force. I mean, you're getting your max money, which you want, and you're forcing the Cavs to make a decision, which you also want.
Right.
But I just think like, and granted, this isn't a great way to go off this stuff, but how leaky is this camp? Like, we wouldn't have heard some team offered them, you know, 580 or 560 or whatever. Like, we wouldn't have
heard
that.
That's why I wonder if it just wasn't there. I mean, look. What did Draymond end up with? Like 5 for 82?
That sounds
something
right.
Like that?
Yeah.
5 for 85, something like that?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, I don't think anybody in the league, especially coming off the year Draymond had, would be ready to just go pony up to pay more for Tristan Thompson than Draymond.
I agree, but we had that was settled within like 4 days.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. So I think, you know, I think that that's kind of the problem here, is that with the way the system's set up, they probably tried to get an offer that was more than what Draymond was getting.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get one. And they're like, all right, well, the only place we really have leverage is with Cleveland. So we have to just wait this out and see if Cleveland will go up on their offer. And I think that's what the holdup is I think the Cavs are saying, well, there's really no reason for us to go up on our offer because you can't get a better offer, and we're giving you $80 million, and we don't need to give you 85 or 90. We can give you 80. And they just keep saying, well, we want you to give us 90. But if there's no one to give them, the Enes Kanter contract, then they're kind of stuck. And I understand where you're coming from on Rich Paul, and looking at it.
And this is, I mean, granted, just, like, this is not an anti-Rich Paul thing. It's just I've seen this pattern with restricted free agency.
Sure.
And I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but, like, I looked at the – everyone goes, oh, well, look at the contract he got Corey Joseph. Like, he got Corey Joseph $30 million over 4 years, which very nice for a backup point guard. $7.5 million a year on average. But – the previous year, Grievous Vasquez, who I don't think is good, to bring him up again, got 2 years, $13 million. So 6.5. Like, are you telling me in a year where spending started getting out of control that Corey Joseph is $1 million a year better than the year before when there wasn't that spending craze? Like, to me, you know, it's
right.
Just like there's a market value of these guys that I think doesn't get maximized, and that's your job. And I don't think it's an easy job, and I don't think it's something where you just click a button in a video game. There you go. There's the offer. Like, I know that's not how it works, but I just look at that, and I just think, like, okay, we see all these situations of, like, unless it's LeBron, which of his clients have made out better than we thought they were going to? I guess you could say Corey Joseph, but, you know, you mentioned Kevin Serafin. He didn't. You know, Eric Bledsoe.
Well, I think the Bledsoe thing is tricky too, because I think Eric Bledsoe is a guy that the basketball internet fell in love with.
Well, that's another. I mean, I'm not a big Bledsoe guy in the first place, so.
No, I know you're not. Yeah. But I'm just saying in general. No, I know your issues with him. I mean, I'm kind of on your case. No, I don't mean that in a bad way. But you've been open about how you have some questions about the game, and I agree.
I think he's more like.
I agree with that.
I think, you know, people talk about, like, the mini LeBron, and he's a star and all this stuff. I look at him as, like, hey, Mookie Blaylock was really good at everything Eric Bledsoe does. Like, he kind of looks like Mookie Blaylock to me as a player, which is not a bad player at all, but it's also someone you're not
right.
going to, you know, build your franchise around.
Right. He's a small guy. I'm looking at his numbers now. Small guy, super athletic.
Inconsistent
shooter.
He's
already had knee surgeries.
He's
6'1", 190, so he's not big. You know, last year he played 40 games, 43 games. He had a knee injury. So he'd missed time earlier in his career. He missed, I think, 25 games a couple years before that. So he'd already had some injury issues. He'd only really had 1 year as a starter. And, you know, I think getting 5 for 70 for him at that time is a pretty good contract.
Oh, based on what I think of him, I agree. I'm just saying everyone else seemed to think much higher.
I mean, I think it was easier for people to say, oh, well, he should go get the max. Well, you know, there's not many restricted free agents that get the max.
No, I agree. So, no, I completely agree with that. I think for me it was everything leading up to free agency last summer, it seemed like it was just a no-brainer that he was going to get the max. And maybe that's just bad reporting. And maybe that's just not reading the market correctly. for whoever is leaking that information. But that's what it seemed like it was, you know, restricted free agency starts. He's getting a max offer sheet from the Suns.
Right, right. Well, and I think, again, I think that's another situation where the Suns, you know, the Suns have never minded pinching pennies before.
Right, very
and
true.
And if you're the Suns, no, and if you look at it, it's smart business, right?
Absolutely.
If you're the Suns, you look at this and go, hey, we don't have to pay this guy the max. He's not going to have a flood of offers. Let's just wait it out.
And if you're, it could be if you're floating, if you're the Suns and you're floating all year, oh yeah, we're going to match any offer for this guy. Then that can,
right, then
that can hurt
happens?
The, yeah,
then
that can hurt the bidding
bothers,
process.
Then nobody, sure, then nobody bothers. The way free agency is set up, you have everything happening in the moratorium. So if you sign Eric Bledsoe for even the same contract he got from the Suns, that clogs up your books for 3 days while all these other guys are signing. And you have to wait to see if he's going to match, if they're going to match or not. It could prevent you from doing two or three other things. I mean, you know, it's just the way the system's set up, it's just really set up to adversely affect the player's chances to make money.
Oh, man, if I were a team, I would say go get us an offer sheet. We'll match it. Like, that's what I would do. It makes no sense to go out and be proactive with your own player.
Right. And that's where I think the Tristan thing is tricky, because I think – he's a guy that clearly needs more to Cleveland than anybody else.
Certainly.
And he's a guy that, like, I can't see the team that, like, I don't think Enes Kanter is that good, but Enes Kanter is a guy that can put up 20 and 10,
mm-hmm.
right? So some team is probably going to look at that and go, hey, there's a 20 and 10 guy we can sign. Tristan averaged, I think, 8-8 last year. He's a good defender, but he's not a big-time scorer. He's not a great shooter. He doesn't have the skill set that's going to make somebody say, yeah, I'm ready to pay you $16, $17 million a year. Other than to Cleveland, where he fits perfectly what they need to do. And they're a team that's ready to win right now. So I'd be surprised if they could have gotten an offer commensurate with 5 for $80 from somebody else. And then now you're kind of stuck in this situation where you just keep saying, yeah, we want more money. And Cleveland says, nah, we don't want to give you more money. And so now, 2 months later, we're still sitting here. 3 months later, I guess. Because, I mean, the funny thing is this 5 for $80 thing came out, what, the noon of July 1st, I think?
Right around there.
Tristan's going to sign for Tristan's going to sign a 5-year deal for $80 million. And everybody said, oh, okay, that's a reasonable contract. Like, that makes sense. It kind of fits. It's a little high, but, you know, everybody wins. And now 3 months later, to the day, nothing's changed. And we're all just kind of waiting to see if he's going to sign this qualifying offer or somebody's going to give in. I mean, and I don't know how you fix the system unless you just get rid of restricted free agency, which they're never going to do.
Right, because that's a mess in itself.
Yeah, like maybe you make the match time one day, maybe. I mean, then,
I think
you know,
that's
and that includes
the
moratorium.
Move.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, like if you sign a guy July 1st, the team, even though it's a moratorium, the team has to decide by the next day, which even that's hard to do. I mean, it's just hard. It's hard to find an answer, but I do have some sympathy for everybody involved here, because it is just kind of it's a weird system where it doesn't really benefit anybody to give in. And so unless you can find a team that's willing to pony up and give you a big offer, you're just kind of stuck. I mean, do we think Enes Kanter would be signed? I mean, maybe he'd be signed if he hadn't gotten an offer sheet. But I kind of wonder if he'd have been in the same, close to the same position, where it might have been, he might have got done before training camp. But that didn't seem like that was ending anytime soon, that situation. And then I was like, oh, Portland's going to offer him a contract. So then it got resolved.
But that's my point, is like his agent went out and got an offer sheet.
Yeah, that's true.
And I know it's not that simple, but like I think that's the only way to attack it, and not just sit back and hope that the other team gives in. Because if you're Cleveland at this point, you can't give in to that.
Right.
Right. Like that's crazy.
Yeah. No. And I agree. I just, like I said, the thing I just keep coming back to, and the thing I've thought about a lot over the last couple months, is I think they're just kind of stuck, because I really can't see anybody offering the money Cleveland offered him on day one.
Yeah, and you get the leaks of like, oh, three. If he's an unrestricted free agent next summer, three teams are willing to give him the max. Like, yeah, tell me those teams.
Right.
I mean, that's crazy.
Right. Right. And that, and again, like, maybe that's how it goes.
Yeah. But I mean, we won't know.
Cleveland's got Mozgov. Cleveland's got Kevin Love. Cleveland's got LeBron. Tristan, if Kevin Love's healthy, Tristan probably doesn't play as much as he did during the playoffs. He probably doesn't have as great a playoff as he has. He probably isn't in a position to command this much money.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
So it's just a bizarre system, and I don't really know what the right answer to it is, because I don't think that players should be able to leave after 4 years necessarily, because then any smaller market team that's trying to build something is going to have all kinds of trouble keeping anybody, because then they could just go wherever they want just as they're hitting their prime. And it, you know, a team like the Wolves now, for example, team you're familiar with, you know, they trade for Wiggins, they draft Karl Towns, you know, now they've got those guys for 7 or 8 years and they've got a chance to build something. If you have a 3-year window to build something in the NBA, you're done for.
Oh, you're screwed.
So, yeah. So I I'm not somebody that's like, advocates for players to never be able to leave a team or anything. I just don't know what the right situation is. Because frankly, it's silly that we're even having this conversation on October 1st.
Right.
There's no reason that this should be dragging on to end of training camp, where you have this important player who's just hanging out there in the wind, and these guys can't come to an agreement on it. And I don't know if it's anyone's fault. I think it's just the way the system's set up, and now they're all just stuck. And to your point, nobody wants to lose face now. So nobody can really give in. And I don't know. It's just a bizarre situation all the way around.
Yeah. I mean, the only way I can think of of maybe fixing the system is you put a deadline for restricted free agency needing to be completed and you make it early, July 31st.
I mean,
but even then, that's a tricky
situation. Well, you could make this deadline a month ago, right?
Right.
Like September 1st.
Right.
I don't really know why it's October 1st.
Yeah, that doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, that's a weird date.
Yeah, it seems like an arbitrary number. Maybe make it September 15th, maybe make it September 1st.
That's a weird date to me, in the same way that the rookie extension deadline happens 3 days into the season. Like, why wouldn't it just be the night before the season
starts?
Right, because
it's always Halloween.
Right.
Right.
Like, that's also a weird one to me. And, like, I guess maybe the problem is if you make it, let's say we make it August 31st, as the deadline for restricted free agency has to be settled. But then, you could just have teams holding out to whatever the penalty is for either side. Like, I don't know what that would be. And then I don't know if it would have to go to an arbitrator to, settle was their good faith attempts.
You know what I guess the weird thing is, too? Now that we're talking about why this is weird, why is there a date at all? Like, why can't Tristan Thompson sign this contract in December?
Well, I mean, I got to think that they don't want a holdout situation in, like they have in the NFL, right?
I guess so, but I mean, yeah, I'm sure that's why the league wants it, and maybe that's just something the players didn't care about in bargaining, but. It does seem kind of silly. They're like, well, we have this arbitrary day that either you have to sign this tender or it's gone.
Right.
And then what? You know.
And even then, the team could just arbitrarily decide, oh yeah, we'll extend the deadline.
Yeah, and then it's like, yeah, the Cavs could just, yeah, we'll give you more time.
Yeah, you can have more time. No big deal.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is weird. I don't know.
It is.
It's really interesting stuff, but it is weird, and like you said, everybody's got a competing agenda, so you never know where stuff is coming from in terms of, the money that could be out there, or the guy should sign or he shouldn't sign, and this is what he could get, and it's a mess. I'll be as curious as you and everybody else to see what happens by by tonight and see if it gets done. Hopefully by the time this is posted, it isn't already old news and he's done something, because then people would waste a lot of time trying to listen to it.
Well, they're just wasting time by listening anyway, so I'm okay with that. Well, I feel like we tried to fix free agency, restricted free agency. We failed miserably, but at least we tried.
Yes. We just said it was terrible and had no good solution.
Right, exactly. So we did the very young person thing of like, oh, that sucks. Well, how would you fix it? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
that's a millennial move. Right,
yeah.
There.
Hopefully, the next time you and I talk, this will have been settled. Like, not even just hopefully by the time this is posted. Like, hopefully the next time we talk, this will be settled, and we can follow you on Twitter at Tim Bontemps. We read you in the post, and my friend, thank you so much.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me.